Job chapter 40. Then the Lord answered Job and said, "Will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it." Then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to thee? I lay my hand on my mouth. Once have I spoken, and I will not answer. Even twice, and I will add no more." Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm and said, "Now gird up your loins like a man. I will ask you, and you instruct me. Will you really annul my judgment? Will you condemn me that you may be justified? Or do you have an arm like God, and can you thunder with a voice like his? Adorn yourself with eminence and dignity, and clothe yourself with honor and majesty. Pour out the overflowings of your anger, and look on everyone who is proud, and make him low. Look on everyone who is proud, and humble him, and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them in the dust together, bind them in the hidden place. Then I will also confess to you that your own right hand can save you. Behold now Behemoth, which I made as well as you. He eats grass like an ox. Behold now his strength is in his loins, and his power in the muscles of his belly. He bends his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs are like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Let his maker bring near his sword. Surely the mountains bring him food, and all the beasts of the field play together. Under the lotus plants he lies down, in the covert of the reeds and the marsh. The lotus plants cover him with shade, the willows of the brook surround him. If a river rages, he is not alarmed. He is confident, though the Jordan rushes to his mouth. Can anyone capture him when he is on watch? With barbs, can anyone pierce his nose? Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook, or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose, or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Or will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him for a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you bind him for your maidens? Will the traders bargain over him? Will they divide him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons, or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again. Behold, your expectation is false. Will you be laid low even at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he dares to arouse him. Who then is he that can stand before me? Who has given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine." May God bless to our understanding his word. He was about 4 years of age. Someone gave him a Superman cape, and he thought it was really great. When I first saw that cape, I was somewhat amused to read the instructions. It said the child should not attempt to fly. Only Superman can do that. After my initial amusement, I realized it was no joke. It was a serious warning. A child might think that he had the power to fly like Superman and jump out of the window of a multiple-story building. In fact, more recently, my son David told me that he had to restrain Daniel from doing just that. But of course, why shouldn't a child do that? Why shouldn't he think that he has supernatural powers? If he watches the cartoons, and the children's programs on television, he knows that man is capable of anything. Think of that impressive line of heroes. Superman, Batman, Speed Racer, Spider-Man, Wonder Woman, Doctor Who, and a whole host of others. They all convey the same idea, that given the right conditions, the right techniques, the right power, man is capable of anything, including crossing time barriers. I doubt very much if the children's programs and cartoons are as harmless as they are portrayed by the media. The idea that man is all-wise and all-powerful goes back, of course, to the Garden of Eden. Adam was deceived into believing that he could be his own God and that he could do anything. He had great faith in his wisdom and in his ability. But even when men acknowledge and admit their sin, there is still an element of confidence in all of us that we can handle our own life. We can arrange our own destiny. We can take care of things by ourselves. Immediately after the fall, we are told about Cain, who tried to approach God on his own terms. He thought he could handle his sin in his own way. Soon after that, we find men trying to build a tower whose top would reach to heaven. They thought that by their unified efforts, they could overcome the barrier that existed between heaven and earth. Now, I do not mean to minimize man's accomplishments. Some of the scientific and technological advances of this century have been phenomenal. Man is wonderful. He is capable of tremendous and great accomplishments. There are some things, however, that man cannot handle. And one of those things is, man cannot control evil. When I was pastoring the Evangelical Presbyterian Church in Newark, Delaware, some years ago, in the early 70s, the Delaware Retail Association sent me a 7-page letter urging me to preach against shoplifting. I don't know if they thought my congregation was especially needful of that, but actually it was a circular letter to all the preachers. But at that time, that's the early 70s, at that time shoplifting was costing American retailers in the neighborhood of $3 billion each year through stolen merchandise. It was costing the tiny state of Delaware $11.5 million. No doubt the figures are substantially more than that now. And of course, our politicians are aware of this, and they make all kinds of promises. They promise that they are going to be able to prevent and control crime, at least reduce it significantly. And obviously, there are some methods, there are some laws which do take a bite out of crime and inhibit the evildoer. Most of the time, however, our politicians discover, if they don't already know it, not only are they unable to control crime on the streets, they can't even control the prisoners they've already got in custody. And the sad thing is, we cannot always trust the men who make the laws or who enforce the laws. There are, of course, all kinds of sophisticated detection devices and methods these days, which lawbreakers seem to regard as a challenge. And as often as not, they are even more ingenious in avoiding the detection devices that are available to law enforcement officials. becomes more and more difficult to apprehend the professional, the big-time criminal. You'll remember last year, a number of people in the United States were poisoned by Tylenol, at least by taking what they thought was Tylenol pain reliever. Someone, you remember, had replaced the pills with cyanide. And since then, the packages have been carefully sealed to prevent such a recurrence. But one of the detectives working on that case said, "Medical packages won't be absolutely foolproof. Man is too ingenious when he has evil on his mind." Now then, in talking about evil, I should point out that we are not necessarily talking about crime, wickedness, and immorality. Everything in those categories is obviously included. But evil, as we have noted over the past few weeks, is far more comprehensive than that. It includes not only what men do, but what men are. It includes not only what men do, but what they think. It includes what happens in the mind and in the heart. It includes the pride and the vanity that we all know within us. It includes hatred and envy. It includes jealousy and strife. It includes lust and covetousness. It includes greed and impure thoughts. More than that, it includes those pursuits and activities which the world endorses and approves, but which are outside the will of God for the child of God. But as we look at our own hearts and we are aware of the fact of these things lurking in the shadowy corners of our minds and our hearts, as we look into our own lives, how many times there have been when we have resolved that henceforth I'm not going to criticize my neighbor anymore. I am not going to express my temper, my anger in that way. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to cheat again. And we resolve to change those things. But alas, to our dismay, we find that it is not only that it is impossible for us to control evil, not only in the lives of others, but we can't even control it in our own lives. How often we have resolved to stop doing that which is wrong, to turn over a new leaf and start doing what is right, only to discover that the spirit might be willing, but the flesh is weak. When it comes to dealing with others, we can reason, we can threaten, we can command, we can encourage, we can punish, and as a last resort, we can call the preacher. And with ourselves, we can resolve, we can determine, we can try substitutions, we can project the blame onto others, we can find excuses, we can even try prayer. We find, however, that evil is too great for us to handle. We cannot control it. It takes far more than human wisdom, far more than human strength to overcome the problem. Throughout the book of Job, Job and his three friends wrestle with the question of evil. Because trouble had come on Job, his friends saw only two alternatives. Either Job was wrong or God was wrong, and of course that didn't give much of an option. Job, in his heart, knew that he had not done anything wrong that had deserved the suffering through which he was called to go. And because Job's friends kept insisting that he must be wrong because he is suffering, Job was almost pushed into the corner. He was almost pressured to the point where he was ready to say, "It's God that is wrong." Towards the end of the book, God came and spoke to Job. The first thing God did was take Job on a tour of the universe. At least he showed him many things. And as Job looked around the universe, and God asked him, who is it that controls the sea? Who is it that put the stars and the sun and the moon in place? Who is it that controls these things? Job, who is it that makes the snowflake? As Job looked around the universe, he is reminded of the tremendous power of God. The power of God that has made all things, and the power of God that sustains all things. That's in chapter 38. In chapter 39, God showed Job the animal kingdom, took him on a tour of the zoo. And there God tells him and shows him the animals. And he says to Job, Job, who do you think it is that gives these animals their wisdom to know what to do, when to do it? Now that might seem a rather strange answer that God gives to Job concerning his suffering, concerning the problem of evil. But really it is most significant, it is most important. You see, before we can begin to discuss the question of evil and the solution to it, we must first understand the power and the wisdom of Almighty God. We need to understand that God is powerful enough to control evil, but at the same time, He is wise enough to control it properly. He is wise enough to use it for the right end. With that in mind, let us turn to chapter 40. God turns to Job in this chapter, verse 2, you will notice. He says to Job, will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it. Then in verse 8 he asks, will you really annul my judgment? Will you condemn me that you may be justified? This is God speaking. Job, will you condemn me that you might be justified? Now keep in mind the fact that neither Job nor his friends knew the encounter between God and Satan in heaven. Because they knew nothing of that accusation, they did not understand the problem. And therefore, they really could not offer an adequate solution. But because Job had indeed experienced the miseries of life, it would seem at least as though he had a distinct advantage. He could speak from experience. He knew what had gone on in his heart and in his mind. But oh, in spite of his supposed advantage, he didn't understand the question of evil either. Notice God's word there in verse 2. Will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it. Poor Job. Having been shown the power and the wisdom of God, which made him feel like nothing, I suppose, having seen the power and wisdom of God, he's then challenged by God. Notice his response in verse 4. He says, behold, I'm insignificant. What can I reply to thee? I lay my hand on my mouth. Once have I spoken, and I will not answer, even twice, and I will add no more. In the presence of God, Job disclaims any right to speak. Indeed, he disclaims any desire to speak. He says, in effect, I've already said too much. Oh, that those of us who consider ourselves wise could grasp that. In the presence of God, our wisdom is but foolishness. When we understand how little we understand, we too will reply with Job, I am insignificant. What can I reply to thee? strange as it may seem. That is really the first step in dealing with the problem of evil. We are not ready to deal with the problem until we have seen ourselves before God as insignificant. God does not leave it there, however. He continues to challenge Job. I love this passage. God, with loving but firm irony, says in verse 7, "Now gird up your loins like a man. I will ask you, and you instruct me." How would you like it if God came to you and said, "All right, I want you to teach me"? Verse 8, "Will you really annul my judgment?" Verse 9, "Do you have an arm like God, and can you thunder with a voice like his?" Verse 10, God still speaking. "Adorn yourself with eminence and dignity, and clothe yourself with honor and majesty." In effect, God is saying, "All right, Job, do your very best. Muster all the strength and dignity and majesty you can find, and then attack the problem." Verse 11, "Pour out the overflowings of your anger. Look on everyone who is proud and make him low. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him and tread down the wicked where they stand." Job, you say you have the answers. You see a way to humble the proud and to tread down the wicked. Why don't you try? Gird up your loins like a man and attack the problem head on. God goes on to say, in effect, Job, if you can't control the problem of evil by your wisdom and strength and dignity, if you can bring a solution to evil, if you can overcome it by your dignity, by your strength, by your majesty, verse 14, God says, "Then I will confess to you that your own right hand can save you." If you can handle this problem of evil, I will confess to you that you can save yourself. In other words, if you can find a way to overcome pride, if you can find a way to tread down wickedness, God says that he will have to admit that it is possible for a man to save himself. Of course, what God is doing is showing Job the magnitude of the problem. Before we are ready to deal with the problem of evil, we must not only see ourselves as insignificant before God, we must see ourselves as helpless. To emphasize the point, God shows Job Behemoth. Most commentators think that that is a hippopotamus. That's rather interesting, isn't it? How does a hippopotamus fit into the problem of evil? Well, whatever creature it was exceedingly powerful. Not too long ago, only a few weeks ago, in fact, I saw a program on Wild Kingdom, part of a program one night, in which some men went out to capture a hippopotamus. It was rather exciting. They chased the whole bunch of hippopotami, is it? Is that the plural? And they chased them up the river with a road grader. And they singled out one that was about half grown. They figured that they could handle that one. And they shot him with a drug dart. And then they managed to lasso him. And they finally captured him. And after a tremendous struggle, they were afraid to tackle a full grown one. In light of all that, consider God's question to Job in verse 24. "Can anyone capture him when he is watching? Or trap him and pierce his nose?" What a dramatic picture that is. Can't you imagine somebody trying to capture a full-grown hippo, put a ring in his nose and lead him around? You try it sometime and see who wins. In chapter 41, the Lord changes the picture. he begins that chapter by saying, can you draw out Leviathan with a fishhook? Leviathan probably means a crocodile. Several years ago, I was speaking to a group of Aboriginal people in a little town called Normanton up in northern Queensland. It's located right up on the Gulf of Carpentaria in northern Australia. There's not much there, except that the rivers and inlets from the sea are infested by crocodiles. And being aware of this, I thought, well, in speaking to Aboriginals, this would be an appropriate verse, one that they could readily identify with. And so I asked the question in the course of my message, what would you do if you caught a crocodile on a fishhook? And one old Aboriginal lady who was sitting in the back of the group, she shouted out, I caught one. I said to her, what did you do? She said, I ran. So would you. God says to Job in verse 2, can you put a rope on his nose? Or pierce his jaw with a hook? Verse 5, will you play with him as you would with a bird? Oh, I love some of those things that God says there. You notice in verse 3, will he make supplications to you? You've caught a crocodile. Can't you imagine that crocodile saying, please let me go? Or will he speak to you soft words? Can't you imagine? Will he make a covenant with you? Will he agree? Will you play with him as with a bird? Then look at verse 8. God says, lay your hand on him. Remember the battle and you won't do it again. Once bitten, twice shy, as the old saying goes. You remember the battle. You take a crocodile on and you will see who comes out second best. What is God saying? I believe he uses these two very dramatic illustrations to say, Job, you don't have the strength to handle a hippopotamus or a crocodile. How do you expect to handle the problem of evil? The problem of evil is far greater. It is far stronger. Its power is beyond us. So that even if we do deck ourselves with eminence and dignity and clothe ourselves with majesty and honor and say, I'm going to tackle this problem head on, we still won't be able to humble the proud, not only the proud people out there, but the proud person here. We still won't be able to tread down the wicked. No matter how dignified, no matter how majestic, no matter what kind of affront we might put on, and how we might appear to others, we cannot overcome, we cannot control evil. Now, the reason, of course, we cannot control evil is because, as the sons of Adam, we have an evil nature. Adam, in rebelling against God and transgressing the law of God, turned his back on the will of God. And as a result, we, as sons of Adam, we lack original righteousness and we possess a corrupt nature. It is our nature to reject the will of God and pursue a path of evil. It is our nature to reject the will of God and do evil. The reason we cannot control evil is because evil controls us. Jeremiah understood this when he said, can the Ethiopian change his skin or the leopard his spots? Of course, that's a rhetorical question. The answer is obviously no. It's impossible for a man to change the color of his skin or for a leopard to change his spots, to make them into stripes or something else. Jeremiah continues if the Ethiopian can't change his skin and the leopard can't change his spots, then you also, if they can do those things, then you also can do good who are accustomed to do evil. At the outset of the book of Job, we're told that Job was a righteous man who repudiated evil. Was he an exception to this rule? Of course not. God would never have reminded Job of his weakness. God would never have reminded of him of his inability to control evil had he been exempt from evil. Job, as a son of Adam, like you and me, had an evil nature. On what basis, then, did God declare him righteous? God pronounced him righteous because God himself had wrought a transformation within him. While God declared Job righteous because of the work of God's grace within him, he motivated him to do the will of God. And while that was true, there was still a sense in which Job needed to be made righteous. And so the suffering that God permitted to come to his servant was a further work of grace to God, of God in his life. It was a work of grace which enabled him to die more and more unto sin and to live more and more unto righteousness. One of the great lessons that Job had to learn, one of the great lessons that you and I have to learn, is that evil is too powerful. We cannot control it. When we have learned that truth, we realize, of course, that it must be all of God's grace that's going to enable us to live a righteous life and enable us to do the will of God. If evil is going to be overcome and conquered, it's going to take nothing less than the wisdom, power, and grace of God in your life and mine. We can deck ourselves with eminence and dignity. We can put on a good front. But it will be all to no avail. Only the grace of God will enable us to overcome it and to live to the glory of God.